Bob at Mount Sinai, at the Breed Street Clinic in Boyle Heights, where this is a hospital and clinic operated by a Jewish agency. And what was significant about that job and about my experience there is that it was totally different from my experience at the Jewish agency in Boston, where I had left, worked in social work. I think two things combined to make it very different and make for a big change in my attitude towards social work. One was that from 47 to 56 is 9 years, right? 9 years had elapsed since I had last worked at social work. Yes, mm-hmm. From the time I'd worked in Boston. And I had matured and had a lot more confidence in myself. And the second factor was that the woman who was the supervisor at Mount Sinai had a totally different attitude. Her attitude was, what are you doing? Are you doing something that is really helping people? And the focus of what you did in the clinic was very clear. You were helping people with the interpretation of what was required of them when they came into the clinic, and you were helping the doctors and the other clinic personnel understand and interpret to the patient. Mm-hmm. So it was a very clear focus, and if that's what you were doing, it was not, nobody was worrying about whether you were what kind of background you were bringing in, as long as you were accomplishing those goals were. And also, I have to add that I was the only social worker on staff that spoke Yiddish. And many of the patients at the clinic were, if not monolingual, pretty much monolingual in Yiddish. They had many elderly patients from the Jewish Home for the Aged, which was a few blocks away in Boyle Heights, mm-hmm. who came there. And so my Yiddish was a very, very big asset there, because I was the only one who spoke Yiddish on the social work staff. And actually, it was a lot of fun. Now there too, and again, I'm continuing this thread of what I chose to pick up on wherever I went. I was active in another local of SEIU. This was the hospital workers local of SEIU local 399. I think that's, I don't remember
that. It's a good number.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that was a local that was, what shall we say, it was totally undemocratic. They had a contract with Mount Sinai, which was what we call a sweetheart deal. It was a backdoor contract that had been adopted without a vote of approval by the workers who worked there, and I guess they had had the contract for quite some time, and it was less than satisfactory. Anyhow, I was elected the shop steward there, and in the 3 years that I worked there from, I think it was 3 years, from 56,
56 to
60? 4 years. We conducted a lot of struggles with the administration of the clinic, and I guess with the board as well, fighting to get a lot of improvements for the workers besides wages, which were really hard to do when you had a contract in place. So a lot of them had to do with other working conditions and having some say-so about that. And I was a thorn in the side of the administration. As I said, I was a big thorn in a lot of places. But that was in line with my philosophy that it was very important for the workers to become involved in their conditions and what in the say-so about the conditions under which they worked, and this was anathema to the administration. So remember, we are still, by that time, we were in the heart of the McCarthy period. And during these years, Sam, who was a teacher, teachers were under particular scrutiny, and I was, I continued my affiliation with the Communist Party, although...
Were you a registered member?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But registered doesn't mean anything. They didn't have records. They didn't keep records. Well, the Communist Party was underground in
those
days.
I know, but there was always a big deal about registered...
Yeah, okay. Well, that was a word that was used. But there was no place where records were kept and a card was kept that showed that people were members.
There was no register.
No. I mean, whatever registration was done verbally and was done with things that were not kept on record or on file. And it was a time of a lot of, there was a lot of underground, what shall I say, of working in ways that were calculated not to be,
obvious?
Obvious, right. That, in other words, the Communist Party, during the McCarthy period, really was very harassed. We had we did not meet openly, and everything that we did was very carefully. We carefully monitored so that you were careful when you spoke on the phone, so that when you met, it was, you know, you didn't advertise that. You were careful not to let that information get out. And at the same time, many of us were hounded by the FBI. The FBI came many times to my house to try to get me to talk with them. And I refused, and, you know, basically, that was the approach that we had been counseled to take, that we were not to talk with anybody from the FBI. Then they came to my place of work, and Unfortunately, there was a, what shall we say, for them, a happy coincidence of the fact that I was a thorn in the side of the administration at the hospital, in the side of the union. Mm-hmm. The union didn't like me. And the FBI came in, and basically I was given by the administration at the hospital, I was given a choice. They would either fire me for, you know, these accusations, or I could resign.
Mm-hmm.
And they would not, you know, they would not contest it. So Sam and I talked it over, and remember, he was a teacher, and he was our main source of income, and we had two kids. And we decided that I could not risk being fired, in which case it would be become public,
yeah,
and obviously endanger his job, and not only the job that he had, but maybe the possibility of getting another teaching job. So we decided very reluctantly that I would resign, and we also decided that I could not say to the people that I worked with why I was resigning.
That wasn't asked of you by Mount Sinai? You and Sam decided that?
That's, yeah, that mm-hmm. what, that I would resign?
No, that you would not tell...
No, Sam and I decided that, yeah. No, Sam and I decided that. Mount Sinai didn't say anything about it. But Sam and I decided that, because that would mean having to reveal my affiliation, and again, that could endanger Sam's job. And I will say that was probably maybe one of the most difficult decisions I made in my life, to swallow my feelings about myself and my worth, and to not say to these people with whom I had, you know, worked so closely for 4 years, why I was resigning. And it was a terror, it was a blow to them, and for me it just was a terribly, terribly hard thing to swallow. Okay, well, that's the end of that. Something. Oh, I can look at my
notes.
I want to stop here and start back to clarify and to elaborate on what I feel has been a most a most important consideration in all of my work and activities, that there has been a thread or a purpose in all of the work and activities that I did that was, I would say, quite conscious, that the activities and the organizations that I chose to become active in were ones that I felt enabled people to get a sense of their own power, that I didn't just decide, well, I'll go into this group because it happens to be around, but that it was a more conscious decision of picking organizations and activities where people were involved and were involved in moving around their, you know, making decisions about their lives and their activities, and that in my making the choice of what organizations I got involved with, I think that I did consider the effect of working on each project and how it would involve people. I know when I was in Boston, I was working as a social worker in the Jewish Agency, and there was a union there, and I, of course, if there was a union around, I would join it. I mean, there was no question about that.
If there wasn't, well, you'd organize.
That which is true also, although not like there. Although, I shouldn't say not like there. And then, although I was in the professional section of the United Office and Professional Workers of America, which included social workers, primarily in the Jewish agencies at that time, UWAPWA also undertook a big organizing drive of the workers in Faleen's department store, a very large department store in Boston.
And what year was this about?
I would say it was, it had to be about 1947, between 46 and 47, because that was the year that I worked at the Jewish Family and Children's Service. I went to work there shortly after I got married in 46. And UWAPWA launched this organizing drive, which actually Sam, my husband, was very much involved. He was the publicity person for the union. And he was down at the union every night doing leaflets for distribution the following morning. And I chose to become involved in that organizing drive because it was a historic thing. I don't think there had been any effort anyplace else to organize workers in a department store.
You know, the first time?
I don't know. I won't swear to it, but I know that it was definitely considered a historic decision and a very important one that other unions and other places were looking at.
Did you have the same, did they bring out the strike breakers and all of those hideous things?
No, there was no strike. We were at the beginning of an organizing drive. So at the beginning of an organizing drive, we were out there, and I remember getting up early before I had to go to work and being out there with Sam and a bunch of us, and we'd be giving out leaflets to the about the union and about joining the union to the people who were coming into work, who had to be at work at, I don't know, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, I'm not sure what time it would be. But that was the beginning of an organizing drive. Now, we might be doing that for months. We were doing that for months. And hopefully getting the names of some workers who might be interested, who we might then go to visit at home or arrange to see after work, because it was a place where there were hundreds and hundreds of workers, and it was the biggest department store in Boston, and I think Faleen's was, you know, known in a lot of places. It was you know, a supposedly low-price trendsetter. So it was significant that the union had chosen to do an organizing drive of Faleen rather than Jordan Marsh or some of the other department stores there. And what I'm saying is that it was a conscious decision. I didn't have to, just because I was a member of the union, participate in that, but made that decision because it was something that was very exciting and very important and, you know, hopefully going to set a precedent for being able to organize huge numbers of workers throughout the country. Because UAPA primarily had been noted not even for organizing social service workers, but for organizing insurance agents. That's who they had contracts with. John Hancock and Metropolitan. Yes, that's who they had organized. That's what United Office and Professional Workers was noted for. They had organized, you know, not the whole insurance industry, but they had organized a sizable number in both New York and New Jersey and Connecticut and Massachusetts, I guess, too. Yeah. So it was a big new outreach, and as such, it was very important. So I'm saying that to illustrate why I became involved in that particular activity, that it was a conscious decision. And I'm trying to think about some of the other things. And then in shortly afterwards, in the late 40s, in 1947 and 48, the Independent Progressive Party was being formed. And it was formed first in the, what shall I say, in the, I was going to say the outlying areas, but that's not correct. It was first formed locally in various places, including Boston. And I was very much involved in helping start the Independent Progressive Party.
Involved in what way?
Well, involved in talking to people about the need for a third party. And that was when Truman was president. And there had been the Taft-Hartley Act. I mean, there had been some horrible, horrible legislation. And remember, it was already the start of the Cold War, and that it was not only in foreign policy, but domestically, there were very regressive policies that had been launched. So the need for a third party was very evident. Shades of today, we're talking 1999.
Nothing has changed.
Yeah. And then I was I can't remember whether all of us who went to the National Founding Convention of the Independent Progressive Party in 48 in Philadelphia, whether everybody who went there was an elected delegate. So I can't remember back to say that I was an elected delegate or not, or whether anybody who wanted to could go.
But you did go.
I did go. Sam and I did go, and it was, you know, it was a tremendous, tremendously exciting and a moving experience. There were, God, I don't know, several thousand people who were there. And that was where they nominated Henry Wallace for president and Glenn, whose last name I can't remember.
Perhaps
somehow
you could describe him.
Glenn, the candidate for vice president, was a person from a western state, it seems to me, and his first name was Glenn, and somehow or other I want to say Stryker, but it's not Stryker. I can't remember what his last name was, but he was a very tall, rangy, skinny guy who somehow or other had an Abraham Lincolnish look about him, and and there was, you know, a lot of discussion about who should be a running mate for Henry Wallace. I mean, Henry Wallace had been stumping around for a lot of progressive policies prior to this national convention. I mean, he wasn't just picked out of thin air. He had been active for the previous year or more, particularly around what was happening to working people and to farmers in the U.S. And he was very critical of the foreign policy also of the U.S. So the question was, you know, who would complement somebody like Henry Wallace running for president? And I think the idea of a person who was nominated as vice president, even though he wasn't all that well known, was that would bring with him support from Western states. I think he was from Montana or Idaho or someplace in the West, in the far West. So that too was certainly a very conscious activity on my part of something that we saw as a historic breakthrough with the two-party system, which was so detrimental to the interests of both working people and farmers. Farmers were a lot more involved in the political life at that time, it seems to me, than we hear about today. And
perhaps there were a lot more of them at that time.
You're quite correct. There were a lot more of them. And I remember that Henry Wallace made some very radical proposals with the United States cooperating with the Soviet Union. He was very interested in the way that Soviet farmers had developed certain strains of, I don't know, wheat or rice or corn or something, or cotton, I can't remember now. But, and he was urging the U.S. government to, take some lessons from that and to work cooperatively with them. So anyhow, again, I'm putting that in as an illustration of something that I made a decision to get involved in because I saw it as something that was very crucial in the lives of people and involving people in very crucial decisions. And I guess another thing that I think I may have left out at another spot chronologically is that in the early 50s, I was involved in the campaign to save Ethel and Julius Rosenberg.
Well, now, excuse me just a moment. Was this in L.A. or Boston?
Now, this was already in L.A.
So you moved to L.A.
Yes, yeah. Because we moved to L.A. in 1949, right. Mm-hmm. And I became very much involved in the campaign to save Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, which was a campaign that lasted, again, my memory is not very good, and it lasted maybe for almost a year, I'm not sure, and it was a campaign that involved going out and getting petitions signed and getting people to take petitions to other organizations and talking to people in various organizations about the case and where the government was obviously determined to murder these people, these two people, and where we were convinced that it was a total frame-up with the collaboration of Ethel's brother, David Greenglass, who was determined to save his neck. He had also been arrested and was determined to save his neck by making up a story about Ethel and Julian. Mm-hmm. And it was, one of the most, what shall I say, one of the most emotional activities that I've ever been involved in my whole life, because here were Ethel and Julius, young parents, young parents, and parents with two young children,
as you
and were. I was as well.